You know the thing that cats does? You know how they pee everywhere to mark off territory? Well, in southwestern China, in Shaanxi province, there's this ancient seven-story pagoda, a very typical Buddhist temple, and that's what everybody thought it was, until this historian proposed that this is actually the oldest Christian church building and monastery in China. So this very Chinese-looking temple was built in the 600s in the Tang Dynasty with support from the emperor, who had actually embraced the Christian religion until that emperor was no more and the pagoda went to other people's use. Now, not everybody agrees with this historian about the history of that building, but if it's true, then this building is like that flag of the moon. It's a stake in the ground that changes history as we know it about when Christians got to China. That the missionaries in the 1400s were not the first to touch down in China, but actually 800 years earlier, when this monk from Syria followed the Silk Road and was the first to bring Jesus' gospel to that country. So that pagoda marks the spot of the first Christian community in China. So today's story actually is a stake in the ground for Bethel, one of the sacred places in the Old Testament, in the west bank of ancient Palestine, north of Jerusalem. But unlike Jerusalem, it's not there anymore. Just a small Arab village, they think. So today's story tells us why Bethel was so important to the Jewish religion as a place of worship, because Jacob worshiped God there. An encounter got there, and he marked it as a special place in a special moment of his life. The Exodus story is the most important event for the identity of the ancient Jewish people. That 3,500 years ago, before they were a nation, when they were just a ragtag slave population being treated worse than dogs in Egypt, the Bible says God heard their moanings and groanings and sent Moses to go head-to-head with the Pharaoh to win their freedom. But rescue from something is only half the rescue. It's kind of like the end of World War II when the Allies freed the prisoners from all the concentration camps. These people had lost everything, everything taken away from them, their home and their wealth, and they had no place to go back to. To complete the rescue, they needed some place to be rescued to. So that happened when this wealthy French banking family bought a stretch of land for the refugees to settle into, which became modern Israel. For the Hebrew slaves in the Exodus story, that was the promised land in Canaan. That was where God had a piece of real estate for the ex-slaves to homestead to become the nation as God's special people, a people who would live by God's values so they could get along and thrive. And to do that, God gave them a gift, the core values of a civilized people we call the Ten Commandments. And that's the climax of the Exodus story, so much so that the entire five books of Moses at the beginning of the Bible is called the Torah, the law. And Genesis is the bumpy backstory of that, that leads to that climax. Because from the first line of the first chapter of Genesis, when it says the world was formless and void, the storyteller is telling us that the big theme of Israel's story is that everything was chaos until God got his hands around it and made some order out of the chaos. So in the creation story, God pulled back the chaos and made a space for us creatures to breathe air and not drown and make a life. And out of the primordial goo, God built the Garden of Eden in the middle of the wilderness for creatures to thrive, except Adam and Eve walked out of the garden because they didn't want the hassle of life with God. And instead, they opted to make their own civilization in the wilderness. Instead of God's idea of good, they had their own ideas, which rapidly spiraled into murder and violence. So the chaos became more chaotic, which continues to dominate our news cycles today. It's what the lady at Safeway said to me, shaking her head, when my self-checkout machine stalled and she had to come and fix it. I asked her what's wrong with it, and she said, I don't know. have to open it up. With some frustration, she said, "It's chaos. The whole world is chaos." So from the moment Adam and Eve left Eden, the whole backstory is now peppered with God showing up here and there in the chaos, while humans go about their chaotic lives in the Wild West of human civilization. God is quietly working to recruit some individuals to rebuild that garden, where a nation of his people would live out his values, which would allow the conditions for our lives to thrive. Values that not only create order, but the conditions for a good life and good relationships. Interestingly, though, the people God recruits are far from saintly, because these are people shaped by chaos, the way we are shaped by chaos. So the story started with Abraham's father, Terah, and then Abraham's story, and then his son, Isaac, and then today we follow Isaac's son, Jacob, as he carries that backstory forward. Today is the eighth Sunday after Pentecost in ordinary time. So this is a stretch of Sundays between Easter and Advent when we go about lives dealing with the day-to-day challenge of being human, trying to eke out a life in the chaotic world. But because of Easter, we know we don't do life alone. We have each other, hopefully friends who have our backs, and we have God's Spirit with us who goes everywhere we go as a roommate and as a coach, who helps us access the hope and resources and resurrection power that is at our disposal as God's adopted children. So hopefully we're conscious of how our lives are different, even in the chaos, because God is in the business of making meaning and purpose in the chaos. And because the reason God gives us to get out of bed in the morning, and because God is with us and on our side always, like the way God showed up for Jacob at a frightening moment of his life. So here's a prayer for this Sunday, and let's pray that together. O God of Jacob, you speak in the light of day and in the dark of night, when our sleeping is filled with dreams of heaven and earth. May we be open and watchful to your presence in our midst, through Jesus Christ, your dream made flesh. Amen. We don't want to confuse the Israel currently in the news with the one in the Bible. Now, although the backstory of ancient Israel began with God befriending Abraham, Jacob's grandfather, Jacob is actually who Israel is named after, because in the story, Jacob will be renamed Israel. So Jacob's story is Israel's story in some foreshadowy sense. That presumably his entire life and his relationship to God is like a parable of the nation of Israel. So 1,500 years after Abraham, when Israel lost their land to foreign invaders, their people scattered all over as prisoners of war, and just like the way Jacob's descendants ended up as slaves in Egypt in the first place, and in the way history repeats, a remnant after exile was allowed to come back to rebuild their nation. And they got the idea they should write down their story, so at least the story might live on even if they don't. And you can imagine what might be going through their heads, looking at the rubbles outside the window, thinking about the good old days, remembering Bethel and all their patriarchs, wondering where and when exactly it all went wrong. They were supposed to be God's people with God's favor, the people blessed with God's law so they could flourish and thrive. So how did they get to where they were, and where has God gone off to? But Jacob didn't know any of that. He barely even knew God at this point of our story. Of course, probably he knew about Abraham's encounters with God, because how else would these stories have survived? He knows about the friendship pact that God made with his grandfather through stories that the family would tell sitting around a campfire. Because what a tale it was that God sought out this random guy living in Mesopotamia and offered to be friends. When all the gods in the world at the time were moody and scary and needed to be bribed just so people could survive the unpredictability of nature. And out of nowhere, this God offered to bless Abraham with everything he needed to become a nation, including the baby he and his wife desperately wanted but never could have had. That miracle baby came to Abraham when he was 100 years old, and he was Jacob's dad, Isaac. Now, Isaac, though, doesn't seem to have any stories of his own with God to tell. Isaac's life is like a huge gap in the Genesis story. But at this point of the Genesis story, Jacob himself had not had any conversation with God and nothing we would consider worship. So Jacob's spirituality, like his dad's, is as barren as the land he lives in. But a story he probably knows was his own birth story. Isaac married Rebekah at 40, a cousin from the old country. But like his parents, Isaac and Rebekah had fertility difficulties, and so with some prayers and intervention from God, Rebecca gave birth to twins, and it took 20 years. So the twins were miracle babies to Isaac in the way he was a miracle baby to his dad, Abraham. And it was a dramatic pregnancy. As soon as the babies were old enough to move around, there was a nonstop wrestling match within mommy's tummy, all the way to the moment of birth. The two boys came out with the second one grabbing the heel of the first as if there was a race to the finish line. And God told the parents that this was how things were going to be, how it's going to turn out for the twins when they grow up, that there would be two nations. The younger brother would end up bossing the older one. The older boy was red and hairy, so they named him Esau for red. And he would become an outdoorsman, a skilled hunter, spending his days roaming the land for something to shoot for dinner. The younger boy is named Jacob. It's Hebrew for grasping, the way he hung on to his brother. Jacob was physically different from Esau in every way, and Jacob prefers to stay home, close to home, indoors, to the quieter hobbies of his tent. Now, it turns out what God told the parents was a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Isaac, like a typical Asian dad, preferred the eldest boy, and also because he had a taste for wild game. Rebecca, the mom, as a reaction, became protective of Jacob, and she wanted to help Jacob to become the boss of his elder brother, just as God said this was going to happen. So, with this, the sides are clearly drawn in the family. And Jacob, with help from his mom, became a master schemer, which is the other meaning of his name. And so one day, Jacob spotted an opportunity. When Esau came home from hunting starving, and he smelled the lentil stew that Jacob had cooking on the stove, Esau asked for a bowl. And Jacob said, "I will trade you a bowl of stew for your birthright." Now, the birthright is a thing that it's a kind of a family mantle a dad passes to his son, usually the eldest son. And it would mean carrying on in the family name as the patriarch and a double share of the inheritance to take care of mom and dad in their retirement. And so we get our first glimpse into Esau as a person. We see he's someone who lives in the moment. He's not very good with the big picture. Talk about instant gratification, right? Can you imagine trading your whole future, all your wealth and the deed to the house for one bowl of soup? When asked to trade his birthright for a bowl of soup, Esau literally went with his gut. He said, "What good is my birthright if I starve to death?" That's pretty hungry, right? And so for the momentary filling of his stomach, he traded away the whole farm. Now, Jacob's trickery didn't end there. Shortly after Esau took a local Hittite girl as his wife, the family dynamics went from bad to Rebecca, the mother-in-law, saying, "I just want to die." The storyteller says Esau's choice of a wife greatly upset the parents and threw the family into turmoil. And at this point of Jacob's family, they were concerned about building their clan identity apart from the other peoples in the land. because that's how ancient people organized themselves. So they wanted their kids to marry within their own clan, but Esau didn't seem to share in his parents' effort at creating and maintaining structure of their clan, and Esau invited chaos into the family. If Esau didn't think much of his birthright, it's about the same value as a bowl of soup, apparently. We now have a second glimpse into him as a person. He ignores his parents' input about wife, which for a son living in his time and culture shows something about his disregard for his parents and tradition. And so one day, an elderly Isaac with eyes cloudy with cataracts calls Esau over to his tent and asks Esau to hunt him something good to eat. And then he said to Esau, "I will give you my fatherly blessing." Now, there seemed to be some dispute about what this blessing is. When I was younger, everything I read said it was a different thing than the birthright. So maybe because of all the conflict and fighting in the family with Esau's choice of a wife, Isaac has decided to send Esau and his wife to live away from the family compound. And this blessing maybe was some kind of parting words that a dad gives to his son before the son moves away. But some of the recent scholars I read seems to say that this blessing is actually the passing of the birthright. That Esau, the thing that Esau had already traded away for a bowl of soup. If so, then old dad is trying to pull a fast one on everyone for his favorite son. He wants to give Esau the birthright blessing while Jacob and Rebekah weren't looking. Except Rebekah heard them talking. So before Esau could come home from the hunt, Rebekah coaches Jacob to impersonate Esau, complete with a fig, hairy arm and some meaty stew. And Jacob gets the blessing from his dad because his dad thought he was blessing Esau. So when Esau comes home and discovered that Jacob had taken from him everything from dad, a dad has to pass on to a son, Esau gets mad, and he vows that as soon as their dad dies, he would kill Jacob. And so Rebekah knew that to save Jacob's life, she had to send Jacob away. So that's why Jacob was out there in the middle of nowhere, pitching camp for the night with a rock as a pillow, trying to get some sleep, because he thoroughly ruined his brother and the family with his scheming. And his mother was worried that Jacob's brother Esau might actually murder Jacob in rage in the best case scenario, or in the worst case, they would just end up killing each other, leaving the family with no sons. That's why Jacob's parents sent Jacob back to the relatives in the old country with the excuse for him to go look for a wife from his own people and not repeat the thing that Esau did. But actually, what they wanted was to put some distance between the two brothers. And this was a place where Jacob saw a vision in his sleep of a portal connecting heaven and earth opening up. You know, if you've been to a banquet in a hotel, you know they have the secret back corridor behind the ballroom where the servers run back and forth from the kitchen with their trays. They bring food to the ballroom and run dirty dishes back. So they're not running around the front of the hotel with all that stuff. And that's what Jacob got to see. The normally shielded passageway with the hustle of heavenly messengers running around going about the business between worlds. This is God working behind the scene of the chaos that we see in the world. But next to the hustle, Jacob saw God standing there, looking down over him. So here's Jacob running for his life in distress, and God visits him with a reassuring message. "I'm here. I got you. Everything will be fine." So in the morning, Jacob made a little stone altar. He planted a flag. And he named that middle of nowhere place Bethel. Beth is house, El is God. So Bethel is the house of God. It's where Jacob encountered God in a particularly stressful moment of his life. And maybe it's the first moment of his life when the schemer found himself in over his head. And for the first time, he really needed a higher power. And Bethel is where Jacob leaned into God. Now, if you met Jacob at a cocktail party, do you think you'd become friends? Personally, I don't find him somebody I want to turn my back to, because he's likely to stab me if there's something in it for him. But in some sense, he's very human. He's living in an uncertain world where you have to look after yourself. When I was a kid, a man in the church won the lottery. So one day my family and was talking about this as we walked from the car to the restaurant. And we were debating, you know, it's one of those things at the time, whether Christians should buy lottery tickets. And my mom and I were, you know, idealistic. So I said, if God wanted to give us $1 million, he would find a way without us having to have a lottery ticket. But my dad rebutted that with, if you don't buy a ticket, how would you win? So Jacob is that part of us who feel like if something is going to happen, we have to make it happen. That is, until we encounter things entirely out of our control, like a health scare, money issues, earthquakes, and wildfires. It's all the things that pull the rug out from under our lives in ordinary time. And we have to look inside, outside. We have to look outside of us and face our limitedness as vulnerable creatures. You know, 2 months ago, I had a puzzling blood test that got me looking up for that door that opens up between worlds. Now, I'm aware as I tell you the story that, you know, I'm not the first one in this room to have a puzzling blood test. But the blood test says I have extremely low red blood cell count. And I have a friend who's a nurse who says with that kind of numbers in the hospital, they would put you on an infusion. None of my doctors seem to know why this is happening. And so, of course, I go to the internet, and that got my imagination running wild with all kinds of worst-case scenarios like cancer. So with everything I learned to take care of my health, I didn't know how to fix this one. So after a particularly stressful week, I had this conversation with God. Knowing God is just behind some door with his eyes on me, listening. I've lived an interesting life. I said to God, I'm content. I don't know how to fix this problem. So if it's not my time to go, you have to fix it. Now, I just had another blood test. I'm almost back to normal. And I didn't do any of the things the doctor said. Just took some iron pills and ate liver a couple of times a week. Jacob's story makes us ask a puzzling question about how God chooses his friends. Because don't you want to know? Especially those of us who wonder how to make God like somebody like me. And the story leaves us scratching our heads. Jacob, who will be renamed Israel, and is in some sense someone whose life with God is a version of Israel's story with God, as a kind of George Washington figure, you would have thought God would pick somebody more noble, more kind, nicer, rather than someone who's a cheat and a liar. And neither is there any attempt for the people who wrote down his story on paper to make him more noble or heroic. He's just a guy, as bumbling and confused and conflicted as any of us are on any given day. And perhaps that's the biblically important point of the story. That the answer to our question of what we need to do to make God like us, the answer is we don't need to make God like us. He already likes us as much as it is possible and as much as we need him to. Our tics and weirdness don't bother God at all. We don't need to fix ourselves before he will pay attention to us and have feelings for us. And he wants to be friends with us just the way we are, warts and all. So take a moment, begin a conversation with God. God, I can't tell which person I will be today. Kind and loving, turn the other cheek, and I'll be right here. Soft but strong, I will keep no records of wrongs. Or I might be someone else entirely, brittle and judgmental. I'm taking my share, and you deal with it alone. Hard but weak, I will keep every record, darn it. I'm an accountant in this world that does not give me what I'm owed. God, these multiple cells, you know, of course you know, are parts of a whole. You send the love I have to give. You grieve the pain that causes me to withhold. You send your spirit every day not to stitch us back together, but to heal every tender part from the inside out. So, in the meantime, bless this generous self. Bless this breakable self. Bless these many parts and make them whole. Amen.